The Catholic Church has for centuries stood as a center of power and influence throughout the world, with a reach today of over 1 billion members. In America, the influence of the Church rose most significantly during the late 19th and early 20th centuries with the waves of Catholic European immigrants, much to the chagrin of the WASP and increasingly Jewish elites. They reacted by placing immigration restrictions in 1924 in social engineering programs promoting birth control and breaking up ethnic Catholic neighborhoods. After the tumult of the 1960s, the Church began fighting a rearguard battle that to this day still places it on the defense against progressive culture warriors on issues such as homosexuality and abortion.
Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
The military-industrial complex.
A new world order.
But we are here to destroy the control over the industry of other people.
I did not trade arms for hostage.
It's been time to deal.
Hello and welcome to The Myth of the 20th Century. Today we are joined by a very special guest, Tim Kelly. Please say hello.
Good evening. How y'all doing?
We're doing great. Yeah, and I'm joined with...
Doing good, Tim.
With Nick. Hello.
Sorry. Yes. Hello, Adam. I just wanted to shield Tim for our listeners. I've been a listener of Tim's work for a while, and I highly recommend people check him out. It's over at Our Interesting Times. Is that .com,
Thank you.
Tim? I have it bookmarked. I don't usually have to type it
it's
in.
It's like T.H. Kelly 67, something like that on YouTube.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, it's on YouTube. Yeah, they haven't banned me yet, so.
Well, he does an interview format. He has a lot of good guests on, and we're going to hopefully interview him tonight. But let me, before we get into introductions of our guest, just wanted to give a shout to our other co-host, Hank.
Hey, everyone.
Hello. And actually, real quick, let me do a donation. We had a very, very generous donation on Bitcoin from the first initial, starting with the letter M. I will not dox this person any more than that. But thank you very much. And their Bitcoin wallet address was 1BQW. Thank you very much. So Tim, please tell us about your show.
Adam, one more point of order.
Yeah.
Again, to thank everybody who's donated both through Bitcoin and on the Patreon. So that goes to work on this show, but it also now is going to help with a new project that we have started, which is a web journal, articles, written work. It's, you can find it at theamericansun.com. We'll all be contributing. Our friends will be contributing. And if you are interested in contributing, you can find the Twitter account at New Atlantis Sun, twitter.com, and you can get in touch with me there and talk about potential contributions.
Yes, thank you, Nick. And real quick, I would ask you, Nick, why you think this is a unique place versus some of the other alternatives out there. From my point of view, real quick, I would just say that there has been a lot of drama. There's no surprise to anybody who's been in sort of the movement of whatever we all are in. And a lot of these places that have articles end up falling apart just because of unfortunate disagreements among the editors and the contributors. And a lot of it has to do with sort of disagreements over ideology. And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to have actually cultivate some debate as opposed to sort of a party line per se. So if people have differing points of view with sort of a broader sort of ideology of disliking the sort of progressivism and cultural Marxism of our time, as long as you sort of fit under that rubric, we'd love to hear what you have to say. That's sort of my perspective.
Adam, I can speak to this for a moment, and I would actually like to speak to it. Yes, we are setting out to provide a new outlet for written content, and part of my personal philosophy, I'm one of the main editors of the site. My philosophy is that, yes, if you can provide well-written content, it is not something that we don't need to endorse everything that is written. That's not what it's about. And I think that oftentimes people are writing and jockeying with each other for pretty unproductive reasons. And there's a lot of people who have really good stuff and we want to put it out there, but we want to allow people to engage with each other and debate in a way that is productive, because let's, you know, be frank, the only people who read this kind of stuff are our people, generally speaking, you know, and in that there are a lot of subdivisions and disagreements, but we want to allow people to put their stuff out there without having to necessarily toe a specific party line. And so the general concept for the website is just American revisionism. And it's I will be writing on what that means to me and why I think it's a correct description of where we're going with this. But yes, also no gay drama.
The American Sun. Check it out.
.com. All right. So are we ready to have our guest introduce the show real quick?
Let's roll.
Yes, let's do that, please. Thank you, Tim, for indulging us. We've been working on this for a little bit, though. We just wanted to make the official announcement, so thanks. But yeah, tell us about Our Interesting Times, please.
Oh, okay. My podcast or show, I started it, I guess, in the spring of 2015. My inaugural show was with the late, great Dave McGowan. And I guess it's been, you know, since then, about, I guess, more than 300... close to 300 interviews, I guess. But the show is dedicated to sort of analyzing both contemporary, modern, and also historical events from a revisionist or counter-narrative standpoint, understanding that a lot of the received history or understanding of seminal events in our lives and also those before us, well, the official narrative isn't exactly what has happened, or it's been distorted in a way to promote a particular agenda, particularly those I would just describe as sort of the criminal syndicate oligarchs who really run the world. And so that's why I started it, just interviewing these various people whose research I happened upon in the decade or so before. And finally, I decided to leap the technological hurdles and start a podcast myself. And, you know, after many microphones and playing with sound, I'm still a rank amateur when it comes to the technical aspect of it. But I've had the benefit of interviewing, you know, at this point, perhaps 100 or so different guests on various topics. And my idea is just to get their ideas out there, discuss with them a lot of the work, you know, discuss with them their work that I followed, and hopefully, you know, edify and educate the public and get people thinking.
And that you do. I've listened to a lot of really high quality shows with Tim, and it's a hard task to try to unravel a lot of the lies that's put out there. So I think, you know, we can only do it if we work together on it. As corny as that may sound, I think it's true. So thank you for getting good people together to talk. So you had a statement you wanted to make about the Catholic Church. Is that right?
Oh, well, yeah, I've done, basically I want to talk about, say, I guess it was Catholic power and the American Empire, and this particularly in the United States, how the Catholic Church was undermined in the United States by the, the American Empire, for lack of a better term. What I'm going to talk about tonight is going to be an overview, synopsis of some of the research of E. Michael Jones. I've read several of his books, I'm not going to be able to cover as in-depth as some of these books. So some of these I'm going to cover, if people are left wondering about what we're talking about, or we didn't cover something, or it's incomplete and not satisfied with it, there's much more innovation that can be had by, one thing is dozens and dozens of interviews that E. Michael Jones has done on YouTube you can watch, but also his books, Slaughter of Cities, John Cromwell Kroll and the Cultural Revolution.
Libido Dominandi.
Yeah, Libido Dominandi, Baron Metal, and then, of course, the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and its impact on world history. Tonight, I'll probably focus more on the research will be based on the slaughter of cities, urban renewal as ethnic cleansing, and also his John Gardner Kroll biography, because it's relevant, particularly relevant to what we're talking about tonight, the experience of the Catholic Church in the post-war era in the United States. And also, I'll call out or at least I'll give a shout out to David Wim Hof's book, basically a book that's almost 1,000 pages, like all those EMJ books I quoted. So his book, John and Courtney Murray, Time Life and the American Proposition, How the CIA's Doctrinal Warfare Program Changed the Catholic Church. And if you really want to get into this, that I guess there's about 6,000-7,000 pages of reading there. So read it, and a couple of years later, you can start thinking about it, I guess. But there's a lot of material there. So talking about tonight will be based on that research mostly, and whatever you guys have to offer, of course.
Well, so where do we start? I mean, the Catholic Church. When did it become a significant force in the United States? Because I would imagine it wasn't until probably when kind of the Southern and Irish European people came over to the United States, who were Catholic and who started.
Yeah, the latter half of the 19th century. Yeah,
yeah.
Particularly what happened in Ireland, the Great Hunger in Ireland that was brought about by British policy. So you have a lot of Irish, and also the upheaval in Germany in the 1840s, 1848. So a lot of Catholic Germans, this is part of the Kulturkampf in Germany. A lot of Germans come over to the United States in the second half of the 19th century, same with Irish. And that coupled with high birth rates going into the early 20th century created a problem for the WASP elite. One thing is this is demographics. So one thing the Catholics had what worried the WASP elite was the what they called differential fertility. Catholics did not use contraception, and this became a particular issue probably in 1929, 1930, I think when the Anglican Church ratified or approved the use of contraception. And so with Catholics, again, sort of being insular in their own communities, identifying with the church and following church teachings on these matters, they had big families. And then by the 1930s into the 1960s, that demographic power became political power. And the rest was history, and that it had to be broken up. But it was really if you read Slaughter of Cities, it starts around World War One. But for the purposes of our conversation tonight, I'll talk about going back to the Second World War, the 1940s. And in 1941, of course, America is brought into the war after the Japanese raid on Pearl Harbor, and 12 million men are then conscripted into the armed forces in the course of the war. This creates a huge labor shortage in the factories that are going to be required to produce the munitions to pretty much provide the arsenal of democracy, as it was referred to. And so, but all these men are overseas fighting. Who's going to work in the factories? A lot has been made of women and Rosie the Riveter and these things, but they were really a marginal role in all this stuff. Really, you need men to do the work here. And what they did was they facilitated the transportation of many blacks from the South. They were sitting around the South not doing much, South not being very industrialized, and these former sharecroppers from small towns and rural areas in the South. And because of the railroad system, they were able to be transported up north to man the factories. This created a problem because the war planners didn't really provide housing for the newcomers from the South, and they were black. And so what they did is they dumped them into these established neighborhoods, Polish neighbors and these things. And surprise, surprise, there were problems. So in 1942-43, there's some race riots. This former academic from Loyola, I think he was fired from Loyola University. Lewis Wirth is sent in. I think he was working for the Office of War Information and to investigate the riots. And according to Wirth and other war planners, the United States had a nationality problem very similar to the Soviet Union. Basically, ethnic Catholics, their loyalties were suspect, according to Wirth and others. And so it became Catholic assimilation became sort of a war plan or a war objective.
Wait a minute. Isn't that anti-Catholicism?
Yes. Yes. And it's funny because Wirth – they identify Germans, Italians, we're at war with Germany and in Italy, but he also identifies Poles, Irish, They're not at war with them. So they, one characteristic they all have in common was they're all Catholic. So there's something about these Catholic communities that was bothering, Worth and his masters, I suppose. This also coincides, with the publication of An American Dilemma, a book that was been credited to Gunnar Myrdal, the Swedish economist and sociologist. But many people think now that it was really ghostwritten for him by Louis Wirth and also this guy Samuel Stauffer, both at the University of Chicago, a Rockefeller outfit, of course. And, of course, that book posited many things. But one of its primary theories was that America's race problem was irredeemable, particularly with the blacks, and it can only be solved through social engineering. So that's the problem throughout the war. Of course, we're at war until 1945. And in the post-war era, you have in 1949, Paul Blanchard. His American Freedom and Catholic Power is published by Beacon Press. That was a compilation of articles that he had written, I think, for The Nation magazine, a left-wing magazine. And in it, he asserted that America had what's called a Catholic problem, a Catholic question, the Catholic question, I guess some might say, in that the Catholic Church was inherently undemocratic. It was an undemocratic system and alien, meaning they were, I guess, under the authority of the Pope. And therefore, the Catholic ethnics could not be trusted. This is very similar to what Louis Wirth had said during the war. They could not be trusted to be loyal Americans, and they needed to be assimilated. And this would require ultimately the destruction of their these urban neighborhoods, particularly in the North. Paul Blanchard had history. He even around World War One, right around World War One, right after, he and his brother had got into Philadelphia. I think it was Bridesburg was the Polish neighborhood there, and had tried to study them and assimilate them. These things, and they were just turned away. And they said these people are just they're stubbornly ethnic. There's no way these people can be assimilated in these things. So he had a longstanding bias against Catholics in general. So we're talking about the destruction of these cities. And so it became a plan, and there's documents to back this up. Of course, it wasn't just, accident or coincidence or just economic forces and demographics that resulted in the changing of these cities. You had the construction of the interstate highway system, which was a huge government operation, national security operation. At least that was the pretext carried out under the Eisenhower administration. What happened was with the cities was the cities themselves, these urban neighbors were destroyed as a part of a government-directed social policy. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't just by accident.
So this is the E. Michael Jones Slaughter of Cities thesis.
Yeah, in the Slaughter thesis is where he documents, pretty much provides the documents that proving that this indeed was a plan. And it basically was done on the cover Urban Renewal. These things, blight, urban blight, and also desegregation and integration. The war production crisis had resulted in the transport of millions of poor blacks north for factory work. This influx created problems, and when the local Catholics rioted or opposed this influx, they were marked as being racist. So it became a racial issue as opposed to an ethnic or just demographic issue. But the key point here is the problems were foreseen and desired, because you had to have the problems to justify the intervention and ultimately to
create. Step by step.
Okay.
What were the problems that at least they ostensibly were trying to solve?
Well, just think about it. You bring up hundreds of thousands of former black sharecroppers from the South who are used to the constraints in life in the South, small towns. In these things, they're laboring under Jim Crow still in these things, and this is the 1940s, and then they're released into the cities, into these established, white neighborhoods, Polish neighborhoods, German neighborhoods, and these things, with insufficient living conditions, and these things. At the same time, they're in the big city for the first time, and they're in this. You have to look at it from a psychological aspect here. Now, without any constraint. Without the constraints of small towns, rural area, they're released into the anonymity of the big city, where they're suddenly given what some might call freedom, or just lack of accountability. Not to mention the fact a lot of these are males. They're being shipped up without any females. And of course, this creates attendant problems of rape or suspected rape or worries, you know, problems on the street with women and these things, and also crime. Like, you know, similar problems that we see today with mass immigration. And similar to then, this is demographic warfare that's foreseen by the planners. They want this to happen, of course. And this becomes more, I think, coordinated in the 1950s and 60s. But they saw what the effects was. This was the problem. At the same time this is being done, you have, again, I mentioned the interstate highway system, also the development of suburbia. And there are policies being taken to subsidize the development of suburbia, particularly Federal Housing Administration loans. And the same time, and then they're redlining the cities, not providing loans to develop the cities, the same time that they're being labeled as being blighted. This is the 1954, I think it was the Berman v. Parker decision, which legitimized, or the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that, you know, local governments could declare areas blighted and pretty much engage in ethnic cleansing of the area under the name of urban renewal. And so at the same time, again, the influx of blacks from the South into these cities, they're facilitating the diaspora into suburbia.
How did they motivate the blacks to move to the city? I assume they sort of did that on their own, seeking job opportunities, things like that. Are you saying that there was more explicit pushing of them?
Yeah, because basically high wages would do that. You just declare high wages.
Okay.
And so you need to work up north. So you just look, provide the economics, and the economics, you know, has its own logic to it. It's almost momentum. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the fact that, you know, I have to suspect that there were also, you know, the railroads themselves are being used. And railroads have always been a tool of social engineering because they've always been constructed politically here in the United States. So the existence of the railroads themselves.
How come they didn't just raise the wages in the South then to make them move back? Guess they didn't think about that one.
Well, because that wasn't part of the plan.
But the plan is to put them into cities.
You also had
to control them. What's the plan here?
The South was significantly underdeveloped economically, like well into the
70s. Yeah. Until air conditioning became.
Yeah, you can't really like lure them back, quote unquote.
I'm sort of being glib, but it's like, what are the costs of Chicago, the South Side now? I mean, if we really were being honest about this, you know, the sort of Jim Crow culture, as unfair it may have seemed to work out better for everybody, including the black families.
And you don't actually get away from this. You can look at how Giuliani solved New York City's black crime problem, and it was essentially, and still is, in large parts, a fascist police state minus, you know, some aspects of the fascism. Like, stop and frisk is a police state where you have, like, armed mm-hmm. patrols, like, searching for any unaccompanied black men and asking them for, you know, their hall pass and shaking them down and encouraging them to get the fuck off the island. Like, that's the explicit intention of that, and it worked very well. And it's not completely distinguishable from, Bull Connor or something, encouraging with his own police force to stay out of the quote-unquote nice area.
Mm-hmm. And so what you have here also, the backdrop to this, of course, is, yeah, you have, you know, the war planning, the demand for labor, and just the problems of integrating these foreigners more or less from the South. The South was completely different from the North. The South was a sort of a conquered province, and the North was a whole different world up there. And you have to put this in the context of Paul Blanchard's book, American Freedom and Catholic Power, is Catholics grew in numbers and their political power stemmed from the demographic increase. There's going to be a problem from his standpoint of the American system, the American government. How can we trust these people? This is also in the context of the Cold War. Is 1947, of course, Truman signs the National Security Act. CIA is created. Truman Doctrine is declared. Mr. X, George Kennan, writes The Source of Soviet Conduct. So this is containment. This is the CFR plan for the Cold War in 1950. You know, the Korean War, Cold War turns hot on the Korean Peninsula. This is when Dean Acheson says, Korea saved us. So what do you mean by that? Well, because this legitimized the Cold War and got the funding going for NATO and these things. And at the same time, you have to look at the cultural agenda. 1950, the American Jewish Committee is publishing The Authoritarian Personality. And which is more or less a declaration of ethnic warfare against Christians, particularly
specifically
Catholics.
That was from the Frankfurt School, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it was like Theodore Adorno, Daniel Levinson,
right?
And these sides. And basically, it said that the authoritarian personality stated that the source of fascism, they did like a score in these things, a fascist score, and you know, some of this cockamamie sociology stuff.
Is that why everybody does press an F score on Twitter?
I'm sorry.
I think F stood for fascism.
No, that comes
no,
from
that's
video
from
games.
Video game.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an F score.
It's been a while since I picked up a controller.
Yeah. There's like a personality type that Adorno said it was like and one of them was like a stereotyping, superstition, also an exaggerated concern over sex. Read Catholic. Right. So basically, it said that the source of this was the family, particularly the role of the father in the family, the strong father, the father read Führer and these things. So this idea of in order to weaken the threat of fascism, you had to more or less, well, culturally debase the country, weaken the family, and spread the doctrine of sexual liberty, which would happen the next few years, because you have a. At the same time, Alfred Kinsey, his research is being studied by the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations. He publishes his book on male sexuality, Sexuality in Human Male in 1948. Then 5 years later, Sexuality in the Human Female. And then he's placed on the cover of Time magazine for some reason. Apparently, he's so brilliant, he's put on the cover of Time. So he's being promoted. So this is the sort of the cultural backdrop to what's going on here. All this, again, is looking at very, very suspiciously at the growth of Catholics in America, because the demographics, again, they're not contracepting. They're not engaging in contraceptives. And so this is the baby boom.
Can I ask you about that a little bit?
Sure.
So contraception today takes many forms. But in the mm-hmm. past, especially prior to the birth control pill, what is that referring to? The condom or what else?
Barium condom, yeah.
Okay.
Because not until the 1960s.
Because today I've heard Catholics do practice birth control, despite what the church may advise them not to do.
I would say that well over 80, probably 80-90% do, yes. And that's all part of the war on Catholic Church. So the turning that demographic. Again, what happened was really is how do you reverse differential fertility? How do you get them to stop procreating as much and weaken their power? And you have to do that through psychological warfare. And the key to that, and then another power group here is primarily it's a WASP agenda here being pursued here, but it's also it's an alliance with the Jews, Jewish power. And that's why you have I mentioned the American Jewish Committee and these things. But you have Hollywood. Because of the Catholic Church was able to impose a production code on Hollywood through the production code and also through the Legions of Decency. They were more or less the teeth of the production code. More or less enforced by the Catholic Church. The Protestants had tried to do it, but they kind of fell away from it. And then it was picked up in the 1930s by the Catholics. And again, the key to this restraining Hollywood was the fact that the Catholic Church had immense political power and also authority in the United States, particularly drawing from these ethnic neighborhoods. This was a time between 1934 and 1965. The Catholic Church controlled Hollywood, because in these parishes, the bishop or parish priest would make Catholics swear an oath every year not to go see movies that are corrupting. And they also threatened to boycott Hollywood. In the early 30s, Hollywood was producing some very racy films. And it was Cardinal Doherty, I think, of Philadelphia, emanating from his dense Catholic parish, said, we're going to boycott your films. This is also a time when they invested heavily in color films, and the Depression broke, so they were heavily in debt. And oddly enough, they were able to the Catholic Church was able to approach the Bank of America, which is a ten run, which at the time was run by an Italian, Catholic Italian American.
Yeah, Giannini.
Who used to loan. Yeah, and he would not loan money to Hollywood, and if they didn't you know, stick by the code. So this wasn't a boycott. It wasn't law per se. It was a threat of economic boycott, which controlled Hollywood, you know, put Hollywood on a short leash. By the 19, go forward to the 1950s, and you have suburbia being subsidized by FHA, the 30-year mortgage. Same time, urban renewal, and the threat of and the influx of blacks into these neighborhoods was creating white flight. This is breaking up these dense Catholic neighborhoods from which the Catholic Church derived its power. And once these neighborhoods were dispersed, the Catholic Church no longer had the political power and will to control Hollywood. So the breaking up of the neighborhoods were a key part in the latter sexual revolution, because the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s simply would not have been possible if the country had demographics similar to the 1930s and 40s, because people would have the Catholics would have more would have identified more with the Catholic Church, with their own church, and abided by the rules. Once they were dispersed into suburbia, they may have gone to church, but no longer part of a Catholic community, and they just became white Americans. And that was this is why Hollywood supported this agenda, breaking up the neighborhoods.
So, Tim, I don't necessarily disagree with the E. Michael Jones thesis about the kind of intention behind a lot of these policies. But I mean, I think it behooves me as at least heritage Protestants to point out that, I mean, the Know-Nothings were effectively correct about the impact of Catholic immigration and the formation of kind of a large Catholic population in the U.S., particularly concentrated in these urban areas, that it did lead to the creation of these immense political machines that had serious deleterious effects on the politics of the country as a whole. Like these urban areas ruled by people like LaGuardia or Daley, even as far back as Tammany Hall. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are bastions of insular left-leaning authority that, you know, did not necessarily have kind of coincident issues with the rest of or interests with the rest of the country, if nothing else, just because of their immense personal corruption. So, I mean, when you talk about breaking up and destroying these neighborhoods, like, I think, yes, that was a clear intention. But what do you think about the kind of the interplay in terms of like competition between, I guess, different elites, like these urban machines versus the sort of like heritage WASP Jewish alliance, I guess, heritage on one side, as kind of like competition for control of American politics, rather than just kind of like a one-sided massacre?
Well, that's the key point, is you're talking about a competing power block, which ultimately was what you need to maintain some semblance of liberty in a country, is you can't have this overbearing national power, which was Reed WASP Jewish. And you have to look at American conflict. It's apparently ethnic interest in these things. And we're told not to believe in that anymore. We're all one people, as they say. There's corruption, Tammany Hall, Daley machine, and these things. But compare that to the corruption of the national state or the WASP elite, which was just the norm, over Rockefeller or, you know, over Harriman, or DuPont and the crimes they're guilty of. It's the crimes of, you know, of a Tammany Hall pale in comparison. And I'm not saying that there weren't problems, there isn't local corruption, but from the backdrop to all this is social engineering, and social engineering always involves some matter of psychological warfare and deception and abuse of power, which the Constitution does not grant to these authorities to do. One thing is just this, you know, urban rule, the courts just ratifying the objective of the oligarchs to destroy these neighborhoods under their pretext of blight. And one thing, example, is that is how this would use, the media would step in and help them in these things, like, Time Life. I'll get into like the role of Henry Luce in these things. But they would take pictures of, you know, trash cans. The photographers would actually go in the neighborhoods and kick over, spread trash and take pictures and put it in the newspaper. You know, and these things, you know,
kind of brilliant.
You know, but Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's blight, and if it's blight, then I'll fix it. What do you want me to do? Then, so no, we'll just push you out of the way, under eminent domain in these things. Yeah, I mean, obviously, the downside of these insular communities is there's going to be local corruptions in these things. But then again, compared to what? Compared to the American Empire, the nation state, and nothing can check the objectives of the Eastern Seaboard elite or some neoconservatives who inveigle themselves in the government and do the bidding of Israel and are the game of national interest. The idea of what were the national interests in December 1941? Were they to get the United States into the war on behalf of the British Empire? British Zio Empire, or were they to stay out? And I said, I'd suggest if some of these local powers had more power and say in national affairs, America might have been able to stay out of that conflict. Same with the First World War.
Well, actually, Tim, can you comment on the ethno-religious makeup of the America First Committee, for instance?
Well, that was primarily Midwestern. I had a lot of Catholics, of course, but that was primarily a Midwestern, and like most of the country, was primarily Protestant, I guess, but it represented the Midwestern, central part of the country, the industrial and agrarian part, as opposed to the interest of high finance and Hollywood, which read, you know, WASP and Jew. So the American First Committee is a good example of sort of the essential, the importance of having a decentralized country and of a certain area, recognizing that it has its own interest, be they economic or ethnic, separate from, say, another section of the country. What came out of World War II was this homogenized nation state, and this served the interest of those powers that were looking to create a new world order through their Cold War that they started, which was foreseen by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Council of Foreign Relations as early as 1939. The war and peace studies, when they foresaw permanent American presence in the European continent after victory. So yeah. It wasn't some unforeseen thing. Oh, well, look, the Russians have half of Europe. Who could have foreseen that when you destroy German power?
Tim, when you look at it through this lens of kind of control over, the vast hoard of American resources and geopolitics waged through this sort of demographic warfare. I mean, you look at something that we talk about a lot, the 1965 Immigration Act, co-sponsored by none other than Ted Kennedy, sort of the surviving avatar of Irish Catholic power, and like particularly the normalization and the sort of integration of Irish Catholic power and Catholic power more broadly into the American mainstream. I mean, it almost seems like our current demographic issues are almost the kind of retaliatory strike.
Well, yeah, because you have Catholic quislings like Kennedy working, to undermine true interest of Catholics. That was part of the problem. Was this gets into maybe perhaps later in the discussion, is the role of many Catholics working to undermine the church. And this gets back to just about America itself. What does America represent? Is America itself is sort of a Masonic project? And I would argue that Catholics are in a way alien, and they should be alien to America's Masonic project. And that would be that. And if they recognize that, they can at least play a tempering influence. But when Catholics want to be good Americans, loyal Americans, that means they want to climb the social ladder, get political power. What do they become? They become functionaries of the Masonic American Zio Empire, which is what we see today.
Could we?
I would like to comment on that actually, really quick, Adam. Catholics may have been alien to the American Masonic project, but they were certainly not alien to the European civilization.
No.
Unlike other aliens that were present in America.
No, that's a valid point. What I was going to ask that we discuss a little bit more in detail was, in 1965, the Immigration Act effectively opened the door to Latin American immigration, and to a lesser extent from Asia, which has picked up in recent years. But the largest influx into the United States by far has been from places like Mexico, who are predominantly Catholic. Now, the main sort of accusation of that bill is that it was sort of a kind of Jewish attempt to maybe further sort of dilute the majority of the population, which you could sort of understand why they would want that. But I've never heard the thesis that it was a Catholic attempt to do that. And I don't know.
Definitely a lot of the rhetoric, because it fixed it at the census levels of like the 1910s or maybe even prior to that. Like, it was the previous immigration regime. It was passed in 23.
Okay.
But it was backwards looking in terms of the demography that it attempted to incorporate. And there was this whole bizarre push by Ted Kennedy, which was actually consistent, because later in his career, he did a very similar thing with a different visa class. That this was like one of the effects was an attempt to get more like specifically Irish immigration. I mean, which is kind of like an odd thing. I mean, at the time, like, sure, Ireland was just dirt poor. It really had kind of an economic renaissance in the 70s and 80s. But I mean, at the time,
I would even say the 90s, to be honest, after they had the troubles with the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah,
but be that as it may, go ahead.
Yeah, like, I mean, it seems like kind of a bizarre affectation to us now to kind of care about like Irish from Ireland immigration or demography. But I mean, given his rhetoric, his background, and the fact that during the 80s, there was like a coincident attempt to do it with like H-2Bs or something, some sort of a seasonal or work visa category. There was like a special Irish quota in an attempt to just, you know, get more Irish into the country. I mean, obviously there can be like multiple goals behind something, or like, you know, you can even make the case that it was sort of a pro forma piece of rhetoric, but at least like that rhetorical justification was there at the time.
Yeah, I can see that. What I was actually trying to ask Tim about was, I believe Tim called Kennedy a traitor to the Catholic Church. Now, maybe it's not based on the fact that he's trying to bring in more Catholics to the United States, or maybe it is. But I'd like you to explain why you think he is not a friend of the church.
Oh, well, he was part of that John Courtney Murray Americanist crowd. And, of course, Kennedy's the last surviving brother of the three brothers. You know, Robert Kennedy assassinated in 1968, and, of course, John in 1963. Well, one thing is he became sort of a tool of the oligarchs, particularly promoting things like abortion. And he himself was the liberal social agenda. And so he had lost much of the cultural Catholicism that might have guided him. But this was a trend that started in the 1960s with John Courtney Murray, the idea that Catholics could take a private position different than their public position. And this was, personally opposed, publicly in favor. And this was actually a position that was spelled out by John Courtney Murray in the early 1960s. This helped sort of sell John F. Kennedy to the American people, the first, you know, and only Catholic American president. Kennedy himself, I think, yeah, because what he stood for in the latter half of his, in his career, he was a strong advocate of, you know, things like abortion, and also did very little for the Southies in Boston in the 1970s when their communities were being destroyed by Judge Garrity, another turncoat Catholic.
Tim, I have a question, because when you say like, you know, a public and a private position,
mm-hmm.
I'm not as well informed certainly about this sort of thing as you are, but I get the sense that that is one of the things that people say about Jesuits in particular. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Catholics seem to have a real antagonistic attitude towards the Jesuits, like that that Twitter personality. Is it James Martin? I see a lot of the tradcasts mocking on Twitter.
Yeah.
What's the deal with the Jesuits?
Well, they've never been the same ever since they were busted up in the 18th century. But really, in the 20th century in America, Jesuits have become sort of with Americanists. In fact, their magazine is called the American Magazine, and they're pretty much tools of the establishment. And so it's an order that's probably the Pope should consider. Of course, he himself is a Jesuit. So it's an example. It's an order that's been heavily infiltrated, and much like the Catholic Church itself. So enemies within. And of course, John Curtin Murray was a Jesuit too. So this goes way back. And so the Jesuits themselves became advocates of the state's foreign policy, despite their sort of reputation as being liberal or leftist in these things in the States. Of course, the example of James Martin is a perfect example of that. Promoting all types of ideas that are contrary to Catholic moral teachings, particularly in terms of sexuality.
What is your overall summary of what a Jesuit is versus a mainstream Catholic?
I don't know. I don't know what a Jesuit is anymore.
It's a secret society? Is it sort of
I think like anything, it's just probably they were formed for counter-revolution. So there's always been sort of a plot against the Jesuits to sort of besmirch their name. This is the Jesuits before the French Revolution. And they were very successful.
Yeah, Tim, why don't you, for our listeners who maybe aren't too familiar with the history of the Jesuits, could you give a more in-depth summary about Loyola and the origin of the Jesuits?
Well, Ignatius Loyola, of course, he was the Pope allowed him to start the Jesuits as sort of the soldiers to retake lost territory during the Reformation. And
it was in a way a military order.
Military order, and they involved in there also there was that aspect of it, and there's also the missionary work, which was very successful in the New World in Canada and also in South America. There's the in Paraguay, where they were very successful in developing, giving written language to the tribes there. In fact, they were so successful that their efforts were suppressed by Freemasonic elements within the church, from what I understand. In Portugal and in Spain and France. That's the problem with some of these things is you're dealing with infiltration. So you're not dealing with institutions that are either one or the other. You're dealing with, pretty much a hall of mirrors with these things. And you don't know quite exactly what agenda is being pursued. But their missionary work was phenomenal. And you do have much of the understanding of the original Jesuit order is seen through the lens of the Black Legend. And Whig history and these things, so it's a very distorted history. But the latter day Jesuits are very problematic. It seems very they're always the ones advocating heretical or views on many matters that the church teaches, but from gay rights to abortion, these things. So
I'm told that there's some sort of Jewish narrative or like a narrative about the relationship between the Jews and the Jesuits. And
it's a converso thing or controversy, I think.
Yeah, I mean, but that was like 300 years ago. Is there like I think the allegation is that a lot of Jewish, kind of paper converts in Spain to Christianity became specifically Jesuit priests mm-hmm. and that this had a deleterious effect. That was like more than 300. It's like 500 mm-hmm. years ago. Is there sort of an allegation of like kind of a continuing ideological cross fertilization, or is that sort of just it's like an example of that sort of thinking? So it's kind of labeled with that attribute.
Yeah, that, and I think it's that. I think that's what you're talking about there. But also, I think there's a lot of, messy research, thinking the Jesuits run everything, but which I've never seen any real evidence for. But I do think, like many offices within the church itself, and reading the David Wim Hof's book about how the church was infiltrated, instead of the church being destroyed, it was infiltrated. So many of these orders are going to be infiltrated and utilized, sort of taken over, as opposed to being overtly smashed. And I think that's what you get with the Jesuits, when the Jesuits themselves are the strongest advocates of Americanism versus Catholicism. The ideology of America should guide society, particularly Catholics, as opposed to the teachings of the church. And that was sort of the heresy that was promoted by Henry Luce in the 1950s and 60s, well, the late 40s into the 1960s, when they made John Courtney Murray sort of a superstar to promote that agenda. And this was something that was happening internationally, because the Catholic Church had an international role, and more or less they had a parish in every city in the world. And you could use that office as infiltrate. If you could infiltrate the church and use that to spread the American ideal, this is in the context of the Cold War, then it'd be a convenient tool to have. And that's how I think the CIA and the American establishment saw the Catholic Church. At the same time, you have American Catholics themselves who always want to be loyal Americans as an inferiority complex, perhaps. And I alluded to it earlier, this idea of upward mobility, and they want to be seen as loyal Americans. And they themselves are subjected to the psychological warfare of the Cold War, and you have to pick sides. And so is the church. The church was sort of battered into the American corner during the Cold War, because the argument was, well, if you don't back us, the mean commies are coming to get you, so you got to support us. And this played out in like Solidarity and in the 1970s and 80s with Operation Gladio, the church allowing the Vatican Bank being utilized by all these, secretive intelligence, criminal, organized crime operations, how those things get all murky and mixed up.
I'd like to ask you about nationalism and Christianity. There was a talk that E. Michael Jones gave in, I believe it was the UK, and he was going on about his various stories from the Bible about Jesus and the foot of the cross, stories like that. And there was an older gentleman in the audience who may have had a few too many to drink, but he was interrupting, he was basically saying, we're not religious, we're nationalist. He was making that dichotomy very clear. And people were telling him to be quiet, basically. But he was expressing, I think, a sentiment that I've heard in many circles about the conflict between at least some individuals in the sort of dissident movement who are either ostensibly Christian or ostensibly nationalist. And they see the sort of vision going forward as being separate. And I can also broaden this sort of question or point to contexts like, during wartime, how does the Catholic Church really weigh in on its sort of allegiances? I mean, the Vatican, the seat of the Catholic Church, was, I think, allowed to have its sovereignty by Mussolini, of all people. And it was sort of a question, where do your loyalties lie? And I think that's coming up again and again in any sort of situation where you have a very complex political climate and people may attend church, they may not, but the messages don't always seem to connect. So, Tim, how do we sort of navigate this if we're sort of going to work together, if we're not always of the same religious or political background?
Well, that's nationalism versus universalism, like the Catholic is universal faith. That's what Catholicism means, right? It comes from the Greek word, I believe, universal. Yeah. That's the faith. It doesn't necessarily mean that Catholics also have the principle of subsidiarity, meaning that all decisions should be made at the local level, the most local you can get, and then move up as necessary. So there is a principle of subsidiarity, localism within the Catholic Church, and you can extrapolate from that is the idea of communities, parishes, towns, states, and cities. And so the Catholic Church has no official position on what political or system you should have, or federal system. In fact, what that gets into, I think, actually its ideal system is a confessional state, which contradicts the American system of separation church and state. That's another corruption that set into the church after Vatican II. But the idea is, I mean, you can have a universal claim for a faith and then have local jurisdiction as a practical matter.
I'll give you a sort of practical issue that I personally have had mm-hmm. with churches, and this is not exclusive to the Catholic Church by no means, but upon attending a Catholic church in the upper Midwest, I was sort of slightly disappointed, to say the least, by the pamphlets that they had at the front of the church that were talking about how that particular church was involved in helping refugees from, quote-unquote refugees from Somalia. I mean, this mm-hmm. This is something that has been going on all over the country, obviously, but this is a problem I have with these churches, where I think it does bring to bear into focus the conflict between this sort of universal concept of Christian good faith and goodwill to your neighbor, or your sort of international neighbor in this case, versus people who don't want immigration into their country, like the United States. So mm-hmm. how do you resolve those two things? Because I would not attend that church because of that.
Because, well, this is the problem of the bishops that run the American Catholic churches. They've essentially been bribed by the empire to become tools in demographic warfare. I think the Catholic Church gets close to $100 million a year of government money to care for refugees.
Yeah, Refugee yes. Resettlement Watch is a fantastic yes. blog on this. And the Catholics aren't even the worst example.
So in other words, Tim, your argument would, of course, be that the impetus for the Catholic Church acquiescing to these policies comes from outside of the Catholic Church in the form of cajoling and coercing from the political powers that be.
These are brick and mortar men, as they call it, bishops who just want to have their little empire, their fiefdoms, their buildings and their parishes, and run their businesses and, you know, do whatever they want to do. And they don't want to, and they want the money. And that's what's happening. They're being bribed. Who's paying? I mean, why is the federal government paying to relocate people from the East Coast of Africa to Minnesota? And that's intentional demographic warfare. I think that's similar to moving black sharecroppers up from the South into Detroit into a Polish neighborhood. And it's the same. It's demographic warfare carried out by the oligarchs, by financial interests, or economic, you know, military war planners.
I agree with you. And is there anything that the layman, you know, the sort of laity of the Catholic Church can do? Because my understanding is that that's not really their role. They're not really in the position to not necessarily dictate, but to suggest at the very least to their leaders that they don't like this. So what can they do?
Well, I guess you can don't give money. Don't give.
Yeah, but then you could even say that then they're going to turn even more to the government. I mean,
yeah, at this point, you just got to call them out on it. How many of the lay people, the churchgoers, are even aware of this sort of treachery? I mean, it's a type of treachery people aren't even aware of, this type of social engineering. I mean, dumping, you know, 20,000 Somalis and, you know, into
Minnesota. I think they know it in the back of their minds. They're sort of suppressing it. But I'll bet you that if they had a priest who gave a lecture on this, they would probably support him. But I mean, I don't know what the process is. I mean, how are the leaders selected?
If they had a Father Coughlin, mm-hmm. you know, but he'd probably lose his radio show, just like Father Coughlin did back in the 30s when he was going after FDR.
Right.
He'd lose his racist podcast. Taken down at the host level.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So again, it's the same thing with the current Pope, Pope Francis, going, you know, lecturing Europeans to take in. The Pope also should lecture NATO and the American Empire and Israel for their wars that are raging in these areas, that are destabilizing these areas. Mm-hmm. He should excommunicate Catholics who supported the Iraq, instead of being told, you know, John Paul II being told to support the Iraq war. That's what the people like Michael Novak were doing in the 15 years ago. I don't know, perhaps a church being militant saying, no Catholic can support this. It's you can get people killed. It's an evil in and of itself. But you don't have the church acting that way, because the church, again, seeks to be Americanist. You know, they're loyal. you know, these are, you know, you have, you know, people like, I don't know, he's the Cardinal, what's his name, up in New York, what was his name in the 60s? Spellman. Completely controlled, and from what I understand, he was compromised by Rory Cohn, of all people.
Yes, very interesting.
So this gets into sexual revolution, sex being used as a weapon to control people, and it can be controlled in terms of blackmail or just psychological control. And so you have a lot of the prelates or the princes of the church that we look for leadership are all bought off or compromised one degree or another. That's, you know, that's another dimension. It's very, I mean, you said this, there's so many moving pieces to this, to this issue, that, you know, the role of the church in the United States. And a lot of this also stems with the fact that a lot of American Catholics think that being a loyal American is supporting the state. And it goes back to that, is Americans shouldn't want to get a place at the table. They should be, you know, and at the very least, if they're alien, at least they can have a tempering effect, a modifying effect. And as their numbers grow, they can influence these things. And, you know, we're told that, you know, you know, religion has no place in politics. Well, it's absurd. It's an inherent place in politics. But the secular humanists say that. Leo Pfeffer said that. He said that he believed in the naked public square, that religion should play no part in politics. But secular humanism should play a role in politics. That's their religion.
That's just a propaganda piece they're putting out. Yeah. I mean, it's...
Someone's values are going to prevail, right? One way or the other.
It's a question of exactly values. Correct. That's right. Yeah. Religion is just sort of a very codified version of values. I mean, in my opinion.
It's a descriptive. Yeah. Like, you look at a set of behaviors, and that ends up, like, you label that a religion. But it's not a kind of first principles concept. Like, the Romans had, like, religio, which is just, you know, the name that they gave to all of the rituals that they did and their public morals and everything else. But if you ask them to, like, you know, codify their religion in a nice, neat little book, it wouldn't work. They would look at you like you were some sort of a space alien.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, like, just a really bizarre set of, you know, public religious rituals that, you know, have the same kind of lack of codification, to the point where people think that they're completely divorced from what they traditionally think of as religion. But I mean, we just had a brutal like 2-month campaign over who one of our high priests in our College of Pontiffs was going to be. But now he gets to, like, don the robes, and he interprets the Holy Spirit of our holy book.
Yeah, the bird intro of the Constitution.
And tells us, like, you know, what the spirit of the time, like, you know, is the spirit of the Constitution unchanging, or does it reflect itself in the needs of its people? Like, you know, it's clear as day once you actually look at this stuff. Like, just because, like, he's not speaking to, like, a literal personified deity doesn't mean that he's not, like, being appointed now to do religion.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is a bit of a digression, but I did have a question about one of your earlier points.
Okay, I want to make one point first, though.
Sure.
Thank you.
This is about neighborhoods and the importance of these dense, compact, geographically specific Catholic neighborhoods and the political impact. I alluded to it earlier, talking about how, because of this, the church is able to keep Hollywood on a short leash and hold back the depravity that would later be unleashed in the 60s because of suburbia, because of demographics and the psychological warfare that was waged on America since then through the perversion of Hollywood. In the 1960s, there was a parish in Philadelphia, Most Blessed Sacrament Parish, and it was so dense. It was geographically small, but since Catholics had such big families and small houses, that they were able to elect a state senator, Martin Mullen, to the state legislature in Pennsylvania. And everyone hated him outside his parish, outside his district, because he himself, he was just this Catholic, but he had such immense political power within the state, representing his people. There were a large group of people in this Most Blessed Sacrament parish, and he controlled the finance committee in the state budget and held back government-sponsored birth control. And he wouldn't let any financing go through if any bill went through, the government promoting birth control. And for this, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Quakers, the Jews hated him. He was lambasted in the press and these things. He was old-fashioned. He was a caveman, all this stuff. Well, then in the 1960s, they flooded his district with blacks from the South, South Philly. And all the whites left, and Martin Mullen lost his seat. And now most blessed sacrament parish now is gone. The school, the Cardinal Daugherty school is closed and these things. And the neighborhood's gone to crap, of course. But they got him out of the way and they were able to get the funding through eventually. And this is an example of muscular Catholic power holding something back, social engineering back. And the force for contraception in the 1960s wasn't privacy. I think William Ball, who was a Catholic in Pennsylvania, made this point. So if it's about privacy, then the government shouldn't be promoting it, because in order to promote it, you got to violate people's privacy. It's about promoting. The reason why they made it by in Griswold v. Connecticut in 65 wasn't to let people have access to it. They did. It was to, so the government could get in the business of promoting it.
Case was so specious. I mean, the same people, like the same court that was like, oh yes, your right to privacy, like between you, your pharmacist, your doctor, and the FDA and the whichever funding body, like explicitly rejected any sort of privacy interest in like just mere private communications that were facilitated via a third party. Like these are the same people that, you know, ruled up until very shortly ago that because, you know, you're sending the email through Google servers, I mean, therefore you can have no privacy interests in it, because after all, like the benevolent hand of Google is intercepting that and dealing with every part of that communication. So
And back to the, and this might get back to the next question regarding the immigration issue. I kind of likened it to what was occurring in the urban neighborhoods in the 50s and 60s with the migration of blacks from the South flooding these communities to kick the whites out. The goal wasn't integration. It actually was white flight. It was segregation. But it was to bust up the neighborhoods and get them in the suburbia where they can be subjected to all the psychological warfare that post-war America, mass communication had to offer. And they become white Americans. Within the church itself, you had a bunch of fifth columnists or traitors within the church. One would be like the National Bishops Council and Welfare Council, I think, and also the Catholic Interracial Council, where they supported this because they bought on to the cult of integration, because the spirit of the age was to be just, to be fair, to be good, was to promote integration and desegregation without any thought about what the effect of destruction of ethnic identity would do to the church itself. And I got this from John Cardinal, E. Michael Jones' book on John Cardinal Kroll. Was he was the Archbishop of Philadelphia in the 1960s, 70s, into the in fact in this key moment in 1960s, he was installed in 1961. Was that from the standpoint of the diocese, it didn't make a difference because the archdiocese included the suburbs. So when Catholics left these neighborhoods in the city, went to the suburbs, the diocese kept them. But there's a fundamental change once they left the insular neighborhood and they went in the suburbia. They're no longer part of an intact community anymore. And so this would have a long-term effect. None the bishops didn't seem to understand this. Cardinal Kroll didn't seem to understand this. When someone asked him about, I think E. Michael Jones approached him about this issue in the 90s when he was writing his biography, or 80s. It might have been the 80s because he was healthy in the 80s. John Cardinal Kroll's response was, you can't tell people where to live. So he was completely ignorant of the malevolent social engineering that was occurring. Was planned to disperse the neighbors. This wasn't voluntary. It was they were being terrorized out of the community and being bribed with the FHA.
Tim, can I ask you, what is this sort of awareness in the Catholic laity, at least, or the clergy today about some of what we've been talking about, and especially coming from E. Michael Jones? Because he's fairly well known, and I would imagine in a different way in the Catholic Church. I kind of asked him this question when we had him on our show, but it was... He was kind of clever in how he sort of dodged it, because I don't think he wanted to get anybody, you know, in trouble. But I'm curious what your perspective is of how the Catholic Church views his point of view and his thesis about what happened in the urban ethnic neighborhoods.
I think most lay people are completely oblivious to this, other than people that happen to. I mean, how many people are willing to read a 1,000-page book about urban renewal?
Less than 1%.
Yeah, so that's, and maybe people who have the misfortune to be in my company when I talk about and people who read those books, and then shows like this, perhaps there's some, so you get some, there is some resonance or some meaning to what we're doing today. You're not talking about this because it is getting out. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to pat myself on the back. I found out about it. You know, I'm sorry, I'm not that special. So, you know, so there's some hope that it's getting out there. And I found it, you know, like anyone at least bit curious about, he describes, me, Mike Jones, he described it as he found himself that he was a part of a social engineering plan that he wasn't even aware of. And he found out, you know, find out where we are. How do we get here? You know, why am I living in suburbia?
I guess what I'm getting at is, why isn't he a leader in the Catholic Church? He should be.
Oh, well, that probably speaks to the state of the church today.
Yeah, and why specifically will they not acknowledge someone like that? I mean, he has more following than, frankly, most priests do.
Yeah.
So that alone should demonstrate there's something off.
Yeah. Priests don't talk.
Not only that, he's the most compelling Catholic intellectual to a non-Catholic. I mean, if you're willing to learn from the man, he has so much to teach. And I'm not a Catholic, and I've learned potentially more from E. Michael Jones than I have from any living contemporary writer.
That's the, what I'm trying to make, point I'll make tonight, is that this is of an interest to non-Catholics. The point here isn't to evangelize tonight. The point is, here is to point out that they have a stake in this. The fact that the Catholic, just as a strong Catholic community, as a counterpoint or a check on the ambitions of the nation state, of the American Empire, the Zio WASP, you know, it's more Jewish than his WASP because you've had the Jewish ascendancy since the 1970s. Up into the 60s, it was more of a WASP thing, perhaps. But you have some, again, you have an area of conscious and physical opposition to the empire. And that's one thing that the Catholic Church potentially poses to the American Empire and also to the New World Order, because it's still an institution that's functioning, that's intact, and is in a position to propagate the truth on essential matters. Infanticide and abortion and the population control, these social engineering schemes that seek to reduce the human population and these things. And so it's got something to offer here to even to non-Catholics, because it's just as a counterpoise to something. Again, at the very least, it's a tempering effect.
But then that brings us, I mean, the further we get to the current year, it brings out the element of tragedy in that, because as a someone who comes from a long WASP family and is in many ways an unreconstructed WASP American, I have my issues with some of the European ethnic immigration that took place, particularly in its relationship to organized crime, mm-hmm. and what became of that. However, something I've learned from I accept E. Michael Jones's fundamental thesis about the ethnic power struggles in 20th century America, namely that mm-hmm. the WASP, the Protestant WASP, they dropped the ball in the struggle against a Jewish culture war. And that ball was picked up by the recently arrived Catholic immigrants, and they continued the struggle and then lost. And then, having lost that struggle, we're now faced with this racial cacophony the ethno-religious cacophony that is now America, where no group really seems to be able to stand up to this at this point because of the subversion of that institution that you have been describing, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There was a moment, I think, perhaps in the 1950s, and of course this culminated in the election of John F. Kennedy, a cultural Catholic, but he was an Americanist. But you had, I think it was in July 4th, 1962, when you had, in Philadelphia, you had John F. Kennedy, Catholic president, James Tate, Catholic mayor of Philadelphia, and I think David Lawrence, Catholic governor of Pennsylvania. And of course, a little less than a year later, Kennedy's dead. November 63. So you had this moment, and this was largely driven by demographics. The baby boom was largely a Catholic thing. And if it had been allowed to continue, America would have followed a different path. But these neighborhoods were
broken. Can you explain that, Tim? I haven't really heard that before, that the baby boomers are a Catholic thing.
Well, demographic, I mean, just number-wise, it's primarily majority Catholic.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that either, but you could easily, you know, verify that, I'm sure.
That does make sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, but it, again, this goes back what was occurring. You got to look at this thing and take a holistic approach. What's going on here is in the 1950s, again, I mentioned you had urban renewal, Berman v. Parker. You had the Roth decision regarding pornography. This is sort of the beginning of the legitimization of pornography and the destruction of local police powers to restrain pornography. You have the demographic changes occurring in suburbia. This has an indirect or leads to the collapse of the production code in 1965. This was I think it was The Pawnbroker was a movie that came out where they showed breasts on the screen. And of course it was a Holocaust film. So you couldn't criticize it because you're criticizing Holocaust film and you're guilty of anti-Semitism. This also coincides with 62, 65, you have the Second Vatican Council. And the church is supposedly updating its relation to the modern world. And this is when, again, the CIA and Time Life, working with the CIA, of course, is Henry Luce, Skull and Bones, implements this doctrinal warfare program. And this is a sort of a broader program to utilize religions of all the world against communism. I mean, it's part of the Cold War thing, but the church was a particular target in this.
Can we pause with Vatican II for a moment
and sure.
go over that? We did a show on it, and I was a little bit out of my depth because I'm not as religious as Hans, our co-host who was leading that show, and our other two guests who are quite familiar
with one of those two concepts. Guests, I should add, is on his way to becoming a priest. Congratulations, by the way, Florian. We're very proud of you.
Wow. Yeah, but from what I remember from the show...
Is this Florian Geyer?
Yeah.
Yes, sir, it is.
Oh, yeah, I just interviewed him last week.
Oh, great. I hadn't caught that yet.
I'll be posting it probably tomorrow. So
that's cool.
It's funny.
But I was just going to sort of ask you to review that with us because what I remember... for what it's worth, was there was a lot going on. It was sort of something that the Vatican hadn't done in a long time, and it seemed to be trying to update the church to the changes in the culture with, I would imagine, the main objective of maintaining their membership first and foremost. But the details are too complicated for me because I just don't know all the sort of the terms and the sort of precedents and rules that they follow when they write all this sort of doctrine down. So could you go into some of the detail of what they were doing? And also, I have heard of the sort of CIA influence, but I would not personally believe that the CIA was controlling that. I think they were influencing it like they do with many things. But my impression was that it was primarily a Catholic thing. And there may have been a lot of changes in the minds of the Catholics attending through things like the media, which the CIA does have a lot of influence over. But I do not think it was a bunch of secret agents who infiltrated and then kind of somehow dropped some elixir into the drinks of the holy water or whatever it is, the wine I guess people are sipping when they're talking about these issues and sort of mind control people into changing the doctrine of the Catholic Church. But maybe you can kind of expand on the details of that a little bit.
Well, like you said, yeah, the second Vatican Council, again, was convened in 1962, October 62, to address relations with the Catholic Church, reconcile with the modern world. The church was dealing with the reality of things like television and mass culture and these things and mass communication and transportation. So the church felt it need to sort of revisit these issues. There was no substantive change in doctrine, but there was things like in things like the dropping of the Latin mass, the vernacular mass, and these things. And also the big thing with the Vatican II was the traditionalists will say you have to look at Vatican II in the light of tradition, interpret in the light of tradition. Well, it wasn't interpreted in the light of tradition because the media controlled the perception. And this was where this role of the CIA and Henry Luce, Time Life, and really when you're talking about CIA, Time Life, Henry Luce, you're really getting in semantics. It is CIA. because Skull and Bones is CIA. So the idea was they would control, if they couldn't control the actual documents, and they didn't, they would control the interpretation, therefore the understanding of Vatican. This is where the spirit of Vatican II overtakes the letter of Vatican II. Then you have the problem of how the things were implemented in the church afterwards. And, this, and to my opinion, I think what you had a lot of treachery. It wasn't just a mistake. A lot of perhaps Freemasonic read CIA influence in the church itself that sought to, the way it was implemented was to undermine the church. Into the 1970s, and we saw that, you know, with, I don't know, with folk music masses and things like that, and church design. The official Vatican II actually called for the traditional construction of churches, and just simply wasn't enforced. That's why if you walk into a modern church today, it looks like a, you know, a convention hall or something. It doesn't look like an urban church, and something that you might see, like it looks like a Notre Dame or some cathedral.
That is one thing. If I may pause us to talk about that particular issue. That is something that I've always sort of admired the Catholic Church for, is maintaining the sort of very awe-inspiring architecture that kind of gives you a little bit of a spiritual inspiration and mm-hmm. feeling like you're a little bit closer to God. I'm sure that's the sort of intent. But when you walk into some of these mega churches today in places like in the heartland of America, the South, it just strikes me as odd that anybody would feel compelled to walk into a football stadium effectively and hear the word of the Lord. It just seems very commercial and strange to me. So I do credit the Catholics for sort of having that, at least, tradition. I don't know if it's still maintained as much, but I think it was a smart move on their part.
And this is where the role John Courtney Murray plays in Vatican II, because he was there trying to support the Americanist position. And this documents like Nostra Aetate and Dignitatis Humanae came out of Vatican II. And these documents were, again, misinterpreted. And there's whether it's treachery or naivete, the prelates, the cardinals at Vatican II, didn't understand that no matter what they wrote and proclaimed, it was going to be interpreted in a certain way in mass media. And that was the function of Time Life. In controlling, that's why Time magazine, I think Michael Novak went there, and he was the correspondent there, and he's one, I think, that coined the term spirit of Vatican II, and see where the church opened the doors to the modern world and everyone left, as they said. And so this was again this also coincides what was going on here in the United States at Notre Dame and at Catholic University, I believe, at the same time Vatican II is being convened, 62 to 65, Ted Hesburgh has a secret meeting at Notre Dame with, I think, in relation with the Rockefellers and the Population Council, talking about changing the church's teachings on birth control. And he's meeting with a bunch of Catholic lay theologians, all of whom are liberal or heretical, and they're working to undermine the Catholic churches because they're anticipating a change in church teachings in these things. And of course, that Humanae Vitae 1968 disappointed them, and then they rebelled against it. And you also have Ted Hesburgh at Notre Dame alienating the church, the university from the church by putting under a lay board. And of course, he's at the time he and both John Courtney Murray were being more or less financed by the Rockefellers. Then you have at the controversy of Catholic University in 1967 with Charles Curran. The father there who was undermining church teachings in the university, and when they tried to fire him or not renew his contract, he didn't have tenure, a student protest was staged on the university, and the bishops blinked, and they gave him tenure. They lost control of these universities. That was another thing. The losing control of these universities was a big thing going on at the same time. And again, you see Hesburgh at Notre Dame, more or less being bribed by the Rockefellers, and you have the bishops with Catholic University losing control of the university there, blinking when you had the controversy with Charles Curran. Both times media played a big part of it because the media is controlling the spin, the understanding of these controversies. And the church didn't seem to understand that. I think it's a combination of both naivete and probably treachery within the church, because there's been some, you know, suspicions regarding some of the cardinals there. Cardinal B. I've heard some stories of perhaps the Pope himself was John the 23rd, and also Paul the 6th were compromised in one degree or another. So you're dealing with infiltration. It's hard to really get it. You know, it's not like you're dealing with one side versus another. And at Vatican II, you had this two forces were the Americanists versus what's called the Catholics. And there would be like Charles John Courtney Murray for the Americanist versus people like priest. What was his name? Was it Carroll or I forget the guys that the traditionalist. But that was the Americanist position. And that was the understanding with Dignitatis Humanae was the idea that the American system of separation, church and state was that going to be ideal? As opposed to the idea of the confessional state, as opposed to the American system. John Courtney Murray argued that natural law under the American system with separating church and state was sufficient and indeed ideal. And for the Catholic position, there has been that you need a confessional state where the church is given special privilege to inform and shape the law, and all public officials are devoted to supporting what's called the positive divine law of Christ. And now, be it as it may, America is a different organism, different situation. It's, you know, it's no established church. It's completely different. But at the same time, the American church undermined traditional societies like Spain and Portugal at the same time, promoting Americanism abroad, this ideal, and this destruction of confessional states in the old world. And so you had that dynamic being played out too. And I did now we have a pope today who says that the idea of separation church and state, no established church is ideal, when actually that's a complete contradiction of past church teachings, which creates cognitive dissonance in many Catholics when they hear that.
So and, I've heard mentioned as like kind of a thesis for some of the I guess, organizational rot in the Catholic Church, that there was a decision made, if I recall correctly, circa the 1920s, that local parishes and bishoprics would be allowed to own non-church property with the intention that this be used to open up parochial schools. This had sort of a side effect of turning a lot of Catholic priests and bishops into effectively real estate investors and administrators, and that this sort of selected in terms of your internal success in the Catholic Church suddenly was very tightly linked to these very highly secular concerns about speculating on real estate values and population movements and everything else. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that thesis.
That's I've heard about that too. Didn't do much research on it, but I've heard about that. That's interesting. I think that lays behind this idea of you know the bishop or priest being brick and mortar men. Running a business, and they're to the extent that they're running the little, you know, they're running their empire, they're ignoring their pastoral duties, and that's what you got, you know, in the 1960s, probably earlier than that, because the temptation of the American Catholic Church was American prosperity, and you could do well, and you do well under the system. When you do well under the system, you tend to become loyal to it. So it's again, you're not even saying that the person is even conscious of it. They're just loyal to the system because in America, you can come here, you can do your own thing, you can start a business. It's paradise and these things. But that physical comfort invites a moral corruption. And moral corruption is its own tyranny. It's what Catholics have suffered. That's how the Catholics have been oppressed in the United States. It isn't overt oppression that you might have in some other countries. It's the moral corruption, which is arguably worse because ultimately from a Catholic point of view, what does it matter if you gain the whole world and lose your soul in the final analysis? And, the idea of, again, they're involved in borrowing money from banks, running businesses to expand the school system, they lose focus. And you definitely got that. And that was part of the reason why they were, it goes back to the idea of why the church allowed, their neighborhoods to be broken up understanding that it was the cohesive communities, tight-knit communities, which is the basis of their power, their influence, and but ultimately their ability to save souls and make society, improve society. And they just didn't understand that.
I mean, it really is shocking when you go to some of the urban areas of the United States to see these formerly, I'm sure, well-maintained churches living in these beaten up, busted out neighborhoods. It's astonishing. I mean, and I don't know, again, like how the entire clergy of the Catholic Church, none of them at this point, like other than EMJ, have not come to this conclusion. So have you heard any indication that people have come to understand not this among, or no?
Not a, no, I think the bishops are still clueless in this thing.
This is pathetic.
You know, and another thing coming out of Vatican II was, I think I mentioned this to you last time I talked to you, is a good example of this sort of this bean counter approach, you know, is the E. Michael Jones proposed a plan in Philadelphia to convert Most Blessed Sacrament Parish, the buildings, into subsidized apartments for married couples, young married Catholic couples, so they can come in and have families and reclaim the parish.
Right.
And they said no, that they can get a higher price from somebody else. Think about that.
Okay, and hopefully take this the wrong way, but and this may be part of why, you know, a true Catholic is loyal, but can't you just at this point just say, look, the leadership is too corrupt, we're going to do our own thing? And that's sort of what SSPX did. So what are your views on that and things like that?
Breaking from the church?
Well, breaking from a fallen church, from what I
yeah. Well, at this point, a lot of it. When I listen to the utterances of some of the bishops and these things, I slink back to my local church and support my parish and do what I can in my own parish, because at this point, it can be discouraging, but then again, Christ did promise that the gates of hell shall not prevail against you. And so the fat lady hasn't sung yet. So maybe it isn't time to give up yet. It's tempting to see something in our own lives. Not
takes faith, huh?
Yeah. Wow. Little faith. Yeah. Faith. So, I have to admit it. I can't say it isn't discouraging to see that.
Is that sort of process frowned upon? I mean, by most Catholics, forget the clergy or the leadership for a second, but just your ordinary Catholic, would they object to, let's just say your parish, just say, hey, look, we interpret the Bible as it's always been interpreted. Maybe this is not the right way to go about it in terms of like a PR way, but effectively it's like, look, the Pope is completely off the rails at this point. So we're just going to do Catholicism. You guys are doing something else, but we're going to do Catholicism. Would normal Catholics view that as a bad thing?
I think the usual strategy is to kind of pray and bide time and hope for, hope for the papacy to come to its eventual conclusion. I mean, the papacy, this particular Pope's reign, and maybe something better will come down, will be appointed, will be named, by the College of Cardinals.
Ratzinger, he was the previous Pope Benedict. Well, why was he thrown out? I've heard various conspiracy theories about this, but he wasn't there very long. And that's unusual.
No, he was there from 2005 to 8 years? Yeah, 2005, 2013. 8 years.
He's still alive, right?
That might have some... He's still alive. He's a Pope Emeritus. Yeah.
So, hello. And some, there's something going on, you know.
Some have suggested for him to step back in.
Okay.
I remember his resignation was rather odd. The explanation was, my health and these things. Your health? What? Something that might have had something to do with the fact that he realized he was surrounded by. But then he gets into the, what's going the politics of the Vatican was going on there, and he might have been surrounded. Because he was surrounded by enemies and he had to resign, but that gets into internal politics of the Vatican. One thing I can do is speculate on that.
Yeah.
But another thing that came out of Vatican II was this document Nostra Aetate, which well, clarify their church's relationship with other religions, but really the big thing was with the Jews. And it just clarified and said that not all Jews are responsible for Christ being crucified, which is self-evident. But then that was spun in a way that the Jews weren't responsible, you know, as a political body, as an entity, weren't responsible for Christ's crucifixion. Well, it was obvious that not all Jews were responsible because, you know, John of the Cross and Mary, his mother, they're Jewish, you know. So it was more or less stating the obvious. So the church itself kind of played a rhetorical trick, but then was spun against them. And you have to look at the broader what's going on particularly after 1967, the ascendancy of Jewish power in the West, particularly in the United States, yeah. And in media, you know, and that now with the church, and this goes into such, you know, things like the Holocaust narrative in these things, and now the church can no longer have dialogue with Jews. It can just be lectured to by the Jews. And so this sort of coming out of Jewish power in the 1970s and 80s and the waning of the WASP elite, you know, with the death of the Rockefellers in the late 70s, and there was Nelson and also John D. III, you had sort of a changing of the guard where the tail started to wag the dog, is what I think kind of what we're living under now. With the power, you know, the Jewish lobby, the Zionist power, that seemed to have so much influence in our government.
Well, one of the reasons EMJ is sort of well known in our circles is because of his sort of outspoken criticism of what he calls the enemy of humanity, and that's a quote from him. And he doesn't say all Jewish people are this, but this sort of the Jewish power block is sort of the enemy from the beginning of, you know, the stories coming from the Bible and
Gospel of St. John. So the enemies of
right, and so his sort of recommendation is that, you know, in order to become part of humanity, you must convert to Christianity. But how would you sort of see? Let's just start with Vatican II for a moment. How would you see the church that you would like to see looking like?
Well, I'd probably I don't know, go back to teaching Latin. I grew up without Latin because I was post Vatican II, and probably traditional Mass and these things. And this will gain the capture the imagination and revive faith among the flock. If it started pushing a traditional, give something to sink their teeth into. That's one thing that the weak church didn't have. It wasn't offering in the 1970s and 80s, and people fell away from it. I listen to the experience of some people who've fallen Catholics, and quite frankly, with the experience they tell me, I wouldn't want to be Catholic either if I had their experience. And that's all part of, you know, the suburban church and these things. When they changed the liturgy and they brought in the folk Mass and they brought in, you know, Father Smiley Face, you know, with the long hair and these things. This was all vogue for a while. It seemed all nice and friendly, but then again, at the end, they're not giving anyone any doctrine or belief to believe in. And so, like I said, when they opened the doors, everyone left. This, coupled with the scandals, and this gets into the sexual revolution, is that much of the scandals that we've all heard about in the past few years is a product of the sexual revolution, largely. You can't promote that type of culture and poison the cultural well from which the church draws from and expect it not to have an effect. You also have the intentional sexualization of the clergy. And this is an interesting story because you had this Maryknoll priest, Eugene Kennedy, in the 1970s, who got the bishops to agree to a psychological test of all, you know, priests, of like 200 or 300 priests or something. And he was apparently a devotee of Erik Erikson, who I think his real name was Samuelson. He was a Jewish psychiatrist to a Freudian, and he believed in this theory of 8 stages of development. And the 6th stage was sexual maturity. And the only way you attain sexual maturity is you have a sexual experience. The only problem is the Catholic clergy are celibate. So by definition, they were not emotionally mature. Pathologized.
So how is this guy having a lot of influence, or at least some influence, over the priests? I mean, he's this Jewish guy, and so what? Why do they listen to him?
Well, Eugene Kennedy was a Catholic who followed Eric Erickson, who was Jewish. Yeah, a psychiatrist.
Okay.
And psychiatry, largely psychology, psychiatry is Freudian, and it's kind of Jewish. And it was developed, Freudian theories were developed to sort of treat Catholic or Christian morality as a neurosis because of the guilt you got from it. And the cure was
right.
Drop the morality, you feel no guilt, and that was the cure. So there's a trick there being played there by Freud. And so it's always been that, it sees morality as a neurosis and it pathologizes it.
Listen to these people. I just, at the end of the day, it's like... There needs to be some agency is what I'm getting at. I mean, I do believe that a lot of the sort of Hollywood propaganda that we all saw against the Catholic Church was just that. It was intended to smear the church. Don't get me wrong. But also think that the church did not clean up its own act. And
it didn't. That's self-evident. And then if you read Goodbye, Good Men, he talks about how the seminaries were infiltrated. This is also what happens when a similar operation was conducted out in California in the 60s. The Immaculate Heart Mary Order, I think, where Carl Rogers techniques were applied, self-actualization and basically the idea of free love or sexual liberty was applied to this holy order, and it broke apart. And the thing is, the orders out there were a backbone of the Catholic school system. Once ordinations or vocations dropped, that's how the Catholic Church staffed the schools. That's how they had these community-supported Catholic schools that allowed working-class families to send their kids to Catholic schools. One thing you know is how expensive Catholic schools are now. In my day, my family was sending 5-6 people to kids to Catholic school, and we were paying $800 a year because the parish supported it.
Well, EMJ wrote a short book on Is Notre Dame Still Catholic? And... Mm-hmm. He said, effectively, if you attend that university, you pay $60,000 a year to be a wage slave, a sex robot, and a servant to the empire.
Yes. That's what it is. And you can be a bean counter, but you're a sex robot, and you're a servant, to the empire. And, millions of working class Catholics donated to the Catholic Church to build Notre Dame, and look what they've turned it into. And that goes back to what I said about Hesburgh. And it's just another... it's a diploma mill and a predatory lending institution because they want government money. They want government money. They want the foundation money and government money. And they don't care. They have the architecture still there, from what I understand. I've never been to South Bend. But,
why don't we raise money and get EMJ to – let's build him a church. Why do we need Notre Dame anymore?
Well, we should take back the architect. I mean, the fine buildings going to waste. But I mean, it's go back. You were sexualizing the clergy, and at the same time, you're preaching sexual liberty. Well, the heterosexuals are gonna they're gonna leave, and they're gonna have families. Well, the homosexuals are gonna stay because what are they gonna do? They're not gonna have families, so they're. So you have this, an overrepresentation of homosexuals, and also the idea that they tend to infiltrate and undermine, and that's what they've done in the seminaries. So you had this problem that was sort of ignored to the 70s and 80s, not to mention the fact that once the story gets out, you have to realize, you've had this recent case in Pennsylvania where the Abramson, I think is the name of the state's attorney out there, released document, 300 accused priests, one indictment. And of course it gets out to 300 priests, these are accusations. Only one had enough evidence for an indictment. You have to think that, and there's also thousands of priests. So really, if you compare it to other professions or callings, whether it's teaching, percentage wise, it's still low compared to like public school teachers, low to rabbis, very low to Hollywood compared to Hollywood directors and the casting couch out there, and also they also misrepresent the crisis, the controversy or problem is they call it a pedophilia crisis when really this recent story with McCarrick here in Washington, D.C. It's more of a pederast homosexual thing. It's not pedophilia. It's a different thing. If you're going after post-pubescent older boys, like 16, 17, yeah, legally call it pedophilia, but it really isn't. Or you're going after young men. It's a homosexuality thing. But the only problem is, by the lights of, you know, the modern era, homosexuality isn't wrong. But pedophilia is still a taboo. Thank God. So they call it a pedophilia crisis. But really, it's a homosexual thing. And if homosexuality is wrong, and it's wrong for Cardinal McCarrick, it's also wrong for Harvey Firestein. but they don't see the, you know, the moral logical inconsistency there, because they want to, you know, they want to, as a, at the same time, this also facilitates multiple lawsuits, you know, these things that rich lawyers, the plaintiffs in these things, these cases that have been settled have rich many Jewish lawyers at the expense of the church. Apparently, Alan Dershowitz was claiming that some people are blaming the Jews for the church's problems. Well, if you look back at the information that I just provided about, you know, Eric Erickson and Eugene Kennedy, these things applying Jewish psychiatry, the church sexualizing the clergy and things, not to mention the Jewish influence over popular culture and the sexual revolution. Well, they do bear some responsibility. When they take credit for, you know, promoting pornography, which they do, you know, it's sexual freedom and these things. That's what that book, Smut Hounds and Bookleggers, is about. It's an academic book about the role of Jews in promoting pornography in post-war America and these things. Or that the role of Hollywood, they control Hollywood. They boast about controlling Hollywood. And what effect has Hollywood had on sexualizing American culture? Then they have to take responsibility for it as well, but they don't. So there is some credence to that argument. But Alan Dershowitz himself, I mean, of all people, to point a finger at the problems of the Catholic Church, he himself has been found to be flying the Lolita Express with Jeffrey Epstein. You know,
that's right.
You know, well, Alan, what did you do on this plane? You know, what were you doing down there? But no one asked him about that.
Well, this is what it gets down to. They're following a different religion. They have a different set of values, and so the things that we sort of see as bad, they don't necessarily see as bad, or at least they don't see it as bad for us. And that's mm-hmm. probably where the sort of animosity towards them historically has developed, is because they have double standards. And that's, as you've just demonstrated, something that pisses people off.
Yeah, the traditional church's teachings towards the Jews was eminently reasonable. Secret Judaeus non, I'm not, and again, post-vagging too, I don't speak Latin, so I butchered that. Secret Judaeus non, I think, it was said that the Jew shall be left unmolested, unbothered, but by the general Christian community, no one can bother, you know, molest or bother the Jew. But the same token, the Jew cannot undermine the moral order or the morals of Christians. Now, have they kept their part of the bargain?
I don't think they ever agreed to it, but yeah, that's the thing. It's like, if you let them into your society, you know, they're not going to sign a contract under those terms unless you do have a powerful church, and they certainly haven't agreed to it. So no, but you could also argue they never agreed to it.
When you say Jew, you're accused of it. If you go to Germany, you say Jew, you might get arrested. See, the Jews did this. Well, there is Jewish agency, right? There is there is AIPAC, and there is ADL, B'nai B'rith, and there's the Mossad, and there's the State of Israel, and there's the leadership of greater Jewish organizations. These constitute a Latter-day Sanhedrin, and they organize. And, you know, I was listening to an interview with Michael Jones recently, and he made some of the points I just made, actually. But he's talking about Germany is still paying reparations to the Jews. Okay,
Israel in particular, but yes.
Yeah, so yes, Jewish organizations, not as if individual Jews are getting the money, organizations are getting the money. And still, to this day, for the alleged Holocaust, no one pays reparations to Germans for Dresden, I guess, but they lost the war. But the point is, if the Jews don't exist, then who's casting the check? That's what he said.
Right, yeah, who's I remember that.
You know, it's just like when Neil Gabler says, you know, in his book Empire of Their Own, how Jews shaped American culture. Well, okay, I acknowledge Hollywood's influence, immense influence on the development of American culture, and it's largely or primarily Jewish. If that's the case, then if you can take credit for it, You got to take responsibility for it. You can't say, oh, wouldn't you be anti-Semitic, because now you're blaming us for it. Same thing when Amy Dean.
They don't operate that way, though. So the Jewish sort of culture is it good for us? And that's where they stop. They don't ask about universal morality. Is it sort of love thy neighbor, you know, an eye for an eye? I mean, maybe that is sort of old school, you know, Torah stuff. But the Talmud does not work that way. And that seems to be how most of these people operate.
Well, the thing, the difference in relation to the Catholic Church is that the Catholic Church used to recognize this and had the grammar to enunciate this before the 1960s. And something happened. I think that part of it was the extortion that grew out of the Second World War, the flames of the Second World War, about not only the Germans, but also the entire Western world in relation to the Jews, meaning that there used to be some folk wisdom, street smarts about the problems with relation to the Jews. That's why you could have books, you know, you could something like The Jewish Question, or you could have, eminent people to write about the problem with the Jews and relating to them. And this isn't disacknowledging that, you know, this the very least would have to, would put them on notice and have a dialogue and have them check. Now you have so much chutzpah out there now because there's no check on them anymore, very little. And, because of the control of the media and these things, and to say these things now, which is so obvious, but if you say these things, you'll be written off as an anti-Semite, you know, crackpot and Nazi and these things in the mainstream press, when I think more people than are willing to admit it are sort of acknowledge this problem, you know, if you talk to them in private about these things. And the problem is it going to get worse? And do you want the reaction? And there's always, and historically speaking, there's always been a reaction to these things. You know, I think it was Ratzinger's father, Georg Ratzinger, in the 1890s, was writing about the problems of Jews in Germany and some of the practices they're involved with, the corruption and usury, these things, pornography, prostitution, these things. And more pornography, pornography didn't exist at that point yet because of the film. But and he said, are they going to, you know, reform their ways, lighten up a little bit? Before, you know, the Germans react and pick a leader. And Michael Jones goes, what's the German word for leader? You know,
the F word.
Yes. And so, but the thing is, historically, we're always given one side of the story where we have the Jews as the historically oppressed group. Never hear the other side of the story. It's often a reaction to something, you know, which it's a bit more complicated than that. But the thing is, with the church now has been so weak and it's so ironic now that it can't even enunciate these things. And perhaps this also is a function of the clerical sex abuse crisis, because I think that's an old trick, right? Using that to, you know, honeypot operations. And I mentioned, I referred to it earlier, you had apparently Roy Cohn had the goods on Bishop Spellman.
Well, I'd like, if you have any thoughts on it, what is your take on this whole Kavanaugh fight?
Well, it's kind of funny because I was just talking about that a little bit with Joe Atwell the other night, and you were saying how, you know, for one thing, is they're avoiding some of the real issues, like his role in the Bush administration and the Patriot Act and the torture memo.
I agree with that, actually.
I was like, wait a second. So is this some like ingenious distraction that was put out there?
Don't think so, but maybe. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait, so there's legitimate questions about, you know, about his, you know, him being a judge, justice. But yeah, he'll fit in well up there. Blend in well. This whole thing of the accusations. It's kind of funny because you had Dianne Feinstein, Blumenthal, Chuck Schumer grilling Kavanaugh, the Catholic nominee.
it was pretty surreal how you just saw the mask come off. But what's interesting about him is it depends on how you interpret it, and a lot of that has to do with sort of where you're coming from. I've talked to a lot of people about this, and it usually sort of reveals their preferences and how they view this case. And that's why I found it so fascinating and somewhat disturbing about the state of the union in general. But the sort of ostensible biography of this guy is that he's kind of a Boy Scout. You know, he's this perfect Catholic kid who waited until marriage to lose his virginity. And he played around a little bit in school, but he was so autistic about it, he wrote it down. And so it was like they're taking this guy and they're trying to destroy him, and sort of his defense is that he was just such a dork that he could never have done any of this stuff. And it's like even Bill Maher got to the point where he was like, you know, this makes us look bad. I mean, like, this guy, I was surprised he would even be invited to a party kind of thing. But it's sort of, it's interesting, like, exposition of the Catholic culture in a way. And I wanted you to comment on that if you could.
Well, that's interesting because I live near the area in Georgetown Prep and these things. And you can get into a glimpse of 80s culture and pop culture, and particularly how it affected some of these Catholic institutions, these schools, these Catholic preparatory schools. Well, you know, Hollywood, you know, they're the ones that came out with Animal House and Class. I remember, and what was the other one? Risky Business and these things, telling us how we should live in high school. And of course, these, you know, when Kavanaugh was in high school, he's imbibing this stuff. And so they sexualized the culture, and they've corrupted a lot of these the moral environment in some of these Catholic schools between the 1960s and 1980s degraded greatly because of the culture war itself. And this, someone has to take some ownership for that. So the party environment, these things, you know, going on, getting drunk, girls binge drinking, getting drunk, she doesn't know where she is. So when she makes the accusation, she doesn't know what house she was in. Well, what was she doing like that? Is this normal, healthy behavior for teenagers? Now, by the 1980s, it was normal behavior. I lived it. I was a teenager in the 80s with the parties. I saw these things. I heard some people commenting on what it was like going to a Catholic school in the 1960s, basically before 1965. He said it was a completely different environment. People don't realize that teenagers actually conducted themselves differently back then, you know, but much greater moral probity than they did a generation or two later. It wasn't inevitable. And what creates this? What creates this moral degradation, this declination that we've witnessed? And it's hard for us to imagine because we didn't live it. But if you look at what type of values were promoted in the culture and the music, and this isn't coming out of the ether. This isn't like manna from heaven or something from hell. Human beings are creating this stuff. We're creating the media. And they're doing it for a reason. It's all part of the sexual revolution. It's part of the cultural agenda, the 1960s into the 70s. You know, it was, I think, 1969. If you want to look at a document, there's the Burrison or Jaffe memo of Planned Parenthood in Pennsylvania meeting, discussing how to promote homosexuality and family breakup, and how promoting family breakup, you promote sexual perversion and homosexuality and these things, confusion, weaken society, and thereby. Reduce the population. So that type of malevolence was being discussed. They were commissioned by the federal government to investigate this stuff. So when the federal government gets involved in these programs in the 1960s, you know, like the Gruening bill about getting federal government getting involved in promoting contraception among targeted groups, and they're promoting all this stuff. It's the malevolence is there, and the planning is there. It's there for all to see. And it wasn't as if this stuff was just unfolding.
Well, one of the reasons the left was losing its shit over this guy was they view him as sort of the old school anti-abortionist type from the Catholic community that they have been taught to loathe and dread.
Yeah.
And I am curious what your sort of outlook is for his reign, whatever they call it, in the Supreme Court.
Well, I don't know. Would it be like Anthony Kennedy? Anthony Kennedy was a Catholic.
Is, you compare him to Kennedy, not Scalia or the other Catholics?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to tell, quite frankly. I think what happens in the Supreme Court is one way or another, the oligarchs get the rulings they want at any given time, and they'll confect a majority. You know, Ruth Ginsburg will support Obamacare with Anthony Kennedy because that's the agenda. Scalia's greatest writings are in Scalia dissents when he was in the losing side. Scalia was also bad on a lot of Fourth Amendment issues and torture issue, things like that. So one or another, they'll allow these battles to go back and forth. And at the end of the day, the Supreme Court isn't going to do a damn thing about abortion. Yeah, that's been a trick, you know, it's not, that was part of the agenda. Yeah, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a good example is what he's going through is, First of all, you don't get any substantive hearings on judicial temperament or ideas or view of the Constitution anymore, because no one wants to appoint anyone of any substance, because it just, no, you know, it creates a firestorm or create a target for criticism. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she was appointed to the Supreme Court, she had a long paper trail of activism, like supporting reducing the age of consent down to 12, of repealing the Mann Act and facilitating human trafficking, expunging the word mother and father from all federal law. This was done in anticipation of the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. She was an advocate of the Equal Rights Amendment and these things. That's rather radical. And, if you look at her tenure on the court, it's been to implement the ERA through judicial activism, even though it was turned away by the American people. One of the reasons why ERA didn't pass in the 1970s was because people said, if you read this, the language of the amendment, this can be construed to legalize same-sex unions. It could be construed to require that all male education institutions get government funding open up to women. And this is crazy stuff. Well, lo and behold, she's there, prying open VMI, under the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment requires states to issue gay marriage licenses. When they ratified the 14th Amendment in 1865 or 66, did they really think the men who ratified that intended it to mean that you have to observe or respect same-sex unions, issue same-sex marriage license? But this is modern authority. This is judicial activism. She's just implementing the ERA through judicial activism. But no one bothered to question her when she was appointed, but that her advocacy for lowering the age of consent down to age 12, which is pedophilia. Or a good example, when Kavanaugh, or I think it was Amy Barrett, was being appointed to the Court of Appeals last year by Donald Trump. She's Catholic. Dianne Feinstein saying, "I worry about your dogma as a Catholic." How is
she got a lot of flack for that?
Yeah,
comment.
Your dogma. And it's like, well, did anyone ask Ginsburg about the Talmud?
Let me check my notes there. No.
Okay. Just saying, right? It was good for the goose, it was good for the gander, so to speak, right? In theory.
So in the context of Catholic power in the American empire, where do you see us going?
Well, how to prognosticate? I think the role of the Catholic Church is there as a Catholic is there to teach and lead, not the other way around. So that's the proper role of the Catholic Church. In America, it was supposed to play that same role, but it got seduced by Americanism and was subsumed by the American Empire. Now it is a tool of the American Empire. Unfortunately, in many respects, this isn't to say there isn't some areas within the church that can be reclaimed, and it isn't to say you should stop going to church and praying the rosary. In fact, maybe you should pray the rosary more given the situation we're in today. America itself, I was born into this country. I'm an American. I inherited the situation. Nothing I can do about that. But if you go into what America really represents, is now America is a nation state, a unified nation state empire now being utilized by transnational interests that have no loyalty to the country. At the long term, I think the best thing would be for America to. America will exist. The United States sort of decentralize, and perhaps the way the politics play out in the succeeding decades will allow for a decentralization of power and ultimate breakup, where we can belong to political communities where we can have some sense of real representation and identity, where our true interests can be defended and promoted in goodwill to other countries. Right now, the American it's an empire. It seeks to impose its imperium all throughout the world in the interest of other oligarchic interests. The United States government and the United States is a vessel for these interests, same way the British Empire was, and so we have to acknowledge that reality, and then hope for some sort of peaceful resolution where ultimately the the U.S. government no longer has as much power as it has. They can go out and cause so much trouble to us throughout the world, and we can go back to being perhaps a more normal nation once again. Getting this, perhaps the situation we had in the early part of the 20th century, where you had these ethnic enclaves, that seemed to be a reasonable arrangement, and perhaps the way America, the American Republic existed prior to the 20th century, or even perhaps the Civil War, so-called American Civil War, where it was sort of decentralized and it was less of a problem. But ever since America became so centralized, perhaps in the 20th century, it's become a destabilizing force throughout the world. And that's the reality that we have to face. And the role of the Catholic Church might have been to kind of, again, I said earlier, sort of limit it and temper it and curb its ambition, and hasn't been able to do that, became subsumed by it.
In America, you get foodie. Won't have to run through the jungle and scuff up your feet. You just sing about Jesus and drink wine all day. It's great to be an American. Ain't no lion or tiger, ain't no mob or snake. Just a sweet watermelon and a buckwheat cake. Everybody is as happy as a man can be. Climb aboard, little wolf, sail away with me. Sail away. Sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. Sail away. Sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. In America, every man is free to take care of his home and his family. As a monkey in a monkey tree, y'all gonna be an American. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty.